M16, number 5A.
We continue with the synonymous term soul and take category 5. Here again we come to a category that is rather familiar with us. And, yes, actually I forgot to say, it's cassette 24. And so here we see again how soul has its impact on the opposite. And we find here those terms that we know under soul, that soul is the master, because soul is really controlling the greater, the lesser, as a further term. All that we had on the soul, that the greater controls the lesser, therefore it is the master to a situation. And as soul, it begins to rebuke the opposite, to rebuke, soul rebukes. And by rebuking it, it begins to reverse the situation, transforms the situation or retranslates the situation. Translate and retranslate comes later on. It's a step-by-step process that I try to bring out here. I start again. It's a very nice flow. See, soul is the master. Why? Because in soul, the greater controls the lesser. How does it control the lesser? By rebuking the lesser. By rebuking it, soul reverses the situation and so transforms it. How? By exchanging the object of sense for the ideas of soul, so that that process goes on, the situation is reformed, so it reforms, and by reforming it retranslates the situation back into the identity of things. By retranslating evil back into good, soul acts as resurrection and therefore restores the situation. And in this way leads us from sense to soul through all the wilderness of experience. Isn't that a nice thing? Huh? It's a really beauty. A real beauty. Yeah. It takes in all those qualities which we knew, and just puts it into one category, that category of translating or retranslating the opposite back into the true identity. Well, if that translation takes place, then within ourselves something higher, through the resurrection sense, something higher is being established. So that the human shows forth something more of the divine qualities of soul. So we come to category 6, where we say, what attitude does it raise or raise in the human? It first shows here a sense of meekness. Again, the beatitude, the third beatitude. Blessed are the meek. The meekness is an idea of soul because it says, I lay down everything that is of an egotistic sense. One lays down the self-centered sense and therefore subjects oneself to something higher. So blessed are the meek. This necessitates within ourselves the ability of self-abnegation. Only on the basis of self-abnegation do we show forth really meekness. Therefore it needs an unselfed attitude. You know that attitude which is right in the first paragraph of the textbook, that it shows that prayer is actually a spiritual understanding, an unselfed love. So we have these qualities of spiritual understanding first in the category 4, and then the human aspect of it is in the category 6 as unselfed love, an unselfed attitude, so that we are willing really to take up the way from sense to soul. We are determined now, and therefore the wandering begins. We are willing to take up that way. We take up that way, and on that way, what do we do? Humanly, we identify everything correctly. We identify it. You see, it's something very different than when soul identifies. We are now going and say, now we have to identify everybody and everything and every situation correctly. And in doing that and going through that wilderness, we need some kind of a confidence. So the security of soul translates itself to confidence. We need confidence. The security and of soul translates itself as determination. We are really now determined to go forward. You get here all those qualities which we have in Atonement and Eucharist. That's the third subject. To persevere and to go on, never to go back, not to fall back, not to retrace our step, but be tough and go forward, be determined and be consistent. Here you get these qualities of constancy, steadfastness, perseverance. These are the qualities of Atonement and Eucharist as soul. So as we do that, we show forth and have to show forth a sense of integrity. Integrity means showing forth identity in a human sense, so that we are not wavering. Gives us a sense of stability. We are not wavering. We are not swinging like a pendulum to and fro. Again, the tone of soul in Atonement and Eucharist. We have a kind of stability, and that gives a sense of beauty and of grace. This wonderful touch of soul, which come out of the balance of soul and the joy of soul, that gives a certain aspect of beauty and grace. Yeah. Again, we have these very wonderful qualities that we find in the first, second, and third chapter in the textbook and in the Beatitudes. Finally, we come to the last column, 7, and again, here we find the counterfeit beliefs of soul, but we are no more taking them as counterfeit beliefs, as if they were something next to God or besides God. Here we always take it as being the synonymous term. So the last column is also under the title of soul. Soul is seen to be, when we don't understand soul, to be sin, because sin is missing the mark, is deviating from identity. It is malpractice, because the counterfeit of the sinlessness of soul. Therefore, malpractice, we can see, is actually soul, when we don't understand it. If we feel to be malpracticed, and are the subject of malpractice, we just say, I don't understand anything about soul. Because if we understand something about soul, we will not feel any malpractice. Isn't it wonderful to see, you know, how in earlier times, when people were not in agreement with the church and with Boston, that they felt they had to go down the drain under the impact of malpractice. And the great claim was that anyone deviating, See, deviating, that's a counterfeit of identity. Deviating from the church, you have had it. And actually, when one looks back over the history, one really can see that perhaps, with the exception of Herbert Eustace, practically everybody has had it. And Carpenter, naturally also, he was an exception. But think of it, the malice that was thrown at us through the Dawley and Tawley student over years and years and years. And it has never touched us. I've never suffered under any malpractice because I can't. I just can't. Because I know there is only one soul, therefore one identity. And therefore, if I maintain that attitude, there is nothing left within me that can harbor anything opposite. So it isn't that I never fight against malpractice. I never treat me against malpractice. I always treat for, namely for the facts of soul. That soul is sinless, and I just see all the positive ideas of soul, and that soul only blesses, and that soul can only identify me correctly, and that is a power, and that is the substance of everything, mind and spirit, that's the power and substance of everything. And then you don't feel any malpractice. You can't. So that takes away the fear of it. Soul, when we don't see soul as the spiritual understanding of soul, as the soul testimony, we don't understand that, then we experience soul as sensations, as pain and suffering. But as long as we see soul in its sinlessness, we cannot really suffer. So this is a counterfeit. Another counterfeit, the noumenon counterfeit, is that we have a body. Well, the body is the counterfeit of the identity of soul. Identity is, so to say, the body of soul. If we translate body into a spiritual concept, like Paul has done it, that he speaks about the head and the body, and very seldom Mrs. Eddy has done it in the textbook. Only once she uses body in a positive sense. If we translate it, we can see that our true body is the embodiment of soul. So if we feel that we are entertaining soul and how soul translates itself to us, we are embodying soul, and that's the only true body which we should recognize. The counterfeit of soul is naturally souls many, that we feel that there are many souls, that every body has an individual soul, and has a soul of its own. This is the counterfeit again. So one learns very early in Christian Science that there is only one soul. And that naturally shows us at once that soul must be outside the body, not in the body, because soul is never in anything. And it shows us at once that soul must be unlimited, without any limitations. And so one begins to touch that infinite self of God, which says, that's my true self. The counterfeit, naturally, of the divine ego is egotism. If we don't understand that God is the only I, the only one that can say I am, that nothing else can say I am, if we don't understand that, we are naturally putting our person, our ego, in the center of the universe, and everything then seems to have to turn around that center, that personal center, which is egotism. Also, an interesting point is that the counterfeit of soul is counterfeit, because it's not their true identity. So whatever is deviating from the original identity is called a counterfeit. It is limitation in something, the moment we have a feeling that soul is not unlimited, we misunderstand soul, and therefore we always try to find soul in something. Like in pantheism, which we have as the last one, because pantheism means that everything has a God dwelling in itself. The tree has dwelling in himself a God, the stones have a dwelling in them a God, the animals have a God within himself, and so we have all the pantheon of gods, either in the Greek mythology or the Roman mythology or in the Babylonian mythology or in the Egyptian mythology. It's all one great pantheon, and on the basis of pantheism. Yes, that would be so. Let's go to principle, so that we have enough time for principle. Again, category one, we would say, what is the core of principle? What is principle to itself? And biblically speaking, perhaps we would say, well, it is the divine person, because divine person is the principle of being. But scientifically speaking, we hear that the principle is actually a triune principle. He has within itself a triune nature, namely of life, truth, and love. So we see that we have to consider principle as a triune principle, just as in the Bible, God was called Elohim, and Elohim is as a plural form, which really includes Father, Son, and Mother. Actually, what it does, it includes Mother, Father, and Son, because Elohim seems to be a feminine gender of deity. Still, there is therefore principle that stands for the unity of God himself. It says, what is a principle of being? What is the principle? It is that it is just one principle that unifies within itself all the main aspects of principle. We could say that which defines the core of principle is that it is demanding a science, that the principle is only then the principle when it is explained through a science and as a science. A principle without the science is just not a principle. We cannot perceive of a principle without the science. Without science, it will just be an authority. So that we also can bring out the idea of that unity and that triunity as the infinite one, as an indivisible whole. Can you see the accent really lies on that indivisibility of the one, huh? That it is a one which unites within itself everything that belongs to being. It's an indivisible whole, and as such is absolute. I guess these terms more or less would signify what we understand to be a principle. That we understand the principle of being would be the principle of the person of God, a principle that stands for what biblically was called the person of God. It stands for life, truth, and love as one, and shows that within that one is really gathered together everything into a unity, and that unity is indivisible, that we cannot divide up that unity in any kind or part, so that it is an indivisible whole which is absolute. Now, when we translate that to the level of divine science, then we will have to take in that this principle is the principle of all, the principle of a whole universe, a principle that includes all the universe. Therefore, we must have much more ideas that would depict this. So we could say, perhaps, that this principle is the sevenfold principle. It's not any more just the triune principle, as on the level of science itself, which depicts now the person of God, but now we don't have only to depict the person of God. In divine science, you also have to depict that the person of God as a universe, as a realm, and therefore it would be not enough just to take principle as life, truth, and love. It must apparently be the nature of that universe too. So we feel it is indicating the sevenfold principle, which is the principle of all. You see, it's no more the unity within principle, but that it is now the principle of everything, of the whole universe, therefore operating also in the whole universe, showing really, as we take in idea, that all ideas in the universe, in the whole realm of ideas, have but one principle. So we have again the coexistence of principle and idea, that all ideas not only have one principle, but they have all the same principle. They are all under the same principle. So that principle and idea is one. That's the tone we always had in divine science. If we have principle and idea as one, then we had in divine science also the interrelationship within that universe of principle and idea, but as coexistence. Therefore, in that oneness of principle, we have the indivisibility of principle. I should point out here, see, that we had in the first column that principle is the indivisible whole. And in the second column, I have indivisibility. Can you see the distinction between those two? It is a whole of which it is said you cannot divide it up. Therefore, in the oneness of being, there is no parts. There are no parts. You have the impossibility to divide up the whole into parts. So here we get very much that holism, of which the present age speaks so much, that always shows that the whole is always in every aspect as the whole. And therefore, no matter how much one tries to break it up, one can't break it up, every idea is a reflection of the whole. So really what we have in holism and symbolized in holography is a very wonderful symbol of this principle that, you know, in holography it's a wonderful symbol. If you take a holographic picture, a photograph, a holographic photograph, and you cut it up in tiny little parts, every part always will show the whole, no matter how much we break it up, because every part always has the whole. And if you have any chance sometimes to have to visit a exhibition on holography, go and see it. It's quite fascinating. So it's a completely new sense that we have to get acquainted with, that the whole is indivisible, so that every aspect, in brackets, part of the whole, is never a part. It's always showing forth the whole. I can hardly understand how it is, but it is so, and I can see it. So, when we have the oneness of being, it's really that we say that at every point of being, You always have the whole of God. You never have a part of God, but always the whole of God. Then, in that universe of principle, there is the harmony of principle, because through the indivisibility of the whole, we have not single parts, isolated parts. And the moment we would have isolated parts, they would not play together, they would not be always interrelated exactly together, and we would have discord. But through the fact that there is no divisibility, we always have harmony, because everything is included in one principle. Through harmony, we always get to system, because harmony is only the atmosphere of a system. If we look up, say, the definition of harmony and the definition of system, one can hardly see a difference in the definition. The only thing that is different is that harmony is more or less the activity of that system, but there is no harmony without system, because harmony says, harmos, it takes all the different parts and relates them into one frictionless whole.